You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, and we are just so excited to be back with you. And I am just one of your hosts, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, or at least every single time that we're recording, the one and only Christy Morris. Oh, watch out, cow!
Another cow.
I think that might be the same one.
Oh. Thank you. Glad to be back and talking about something so interesting. Looking back in time, kind of.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think this is going to be a fun one. And obviously, everybody knows, Twisters came out this summer, kind of like a spiritual sequel to the original Twister film, and but we're going to be talking about the original, and I'm sure we'll talk about the latest one here as it comes out on a home release. You saw it in the theater, didn't you?
No.
Oh my goodness. Oh man. I'm not gonna lie. You should go see it before it leaves the theater. It's totally worth it. It's anyway. But that's okay, not what we're talking about tonight. Yes. But we'll talk about that when we get there. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, of course. Give us a star rating review. Help us out by giving us that over on like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, places like that. You can follow us on X, Twitter, and Instagram. On X, Twitter, we're at the 602 Club, and on Instagram, at the 602 Club TFM. You can find us online with the entire network at trek.fm. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. There is a listeners-only discussion group you can join called the Babel Conference, with listeners from all over the world talking about the different shows. And, of course, you can see all the different shows that are happening there online as well. And you can help us out over at Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm and become part of the team. But so, Christy, this is a movie that is one of those that I think, I don't know, it feels like that over the years it's become a more and more popular film, or I guess maybe a cult classic in some ways. But this came out in 1996, and so I'm really interested even just to see for you, because there's enough of an age gap. I'm wondering what your first storm was like seeing this for the first time.
So I don't remember my first viewing. I just know there have been many viewings, and that my first would have been when it was on home release with my dad. And you know, sometimes because of some of the language, maybe something I wasn't supposed to be watching, but dad was like, it's okay. Mom's not home.
I love it.
Just don't That's repeat fantastic. Anything you hear.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I love that. I love that you in some ways too, John Mills, kind of have similar experiences where you had people letting you watch movies that are like, I'm sure it's fine. It's just don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a really interesting movie for me because, you know, 97, I am going into my last year of high school, and I'm going to a ton of movies at this point. It's one of the things that friends and I loved to do. It's actually, I think, in many ways, where I kind of fell in love with going to the movies was like the 96, 97, 98, all those years. And sorry, this one came out in 96, but still, it's right there within that time frame when I'm just going to a lot of movies with friends. And this is also, I think, a film too where, you know, it became such a big deal because the theater experience of it was so pivotal to the movie kind of working, you know. the sound design of the film we'll talk about, and the of course the visual effects of the movie to create this and everything, I just think is pretty astounding in that sense. And so it really was like a kind of an event movie in that way. I would say in some ways it reminds me of Independence Day with that, right? Mm. Like you're just kind of seeing something on screen that you hadn't really seen like this before. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, that's where this movie just kind of talk about the suck zone. This movie really sucked me in. And like you, it's one of those movies where I just kind of kept coming back to, and it became, I don't know if it's like a guilty pleasure film or whatever, but it just became a movie that I could go back and just kind of watch it anytime. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that it's been a really interesting experience for me with this movie, in the sense that, you know, not every movie that came out during that time period is something that I've returned to. There are lots of films that I saw in the theater that, I've really never seen again. But that's not the case for me with Twister.
That's nice to hear. Like, maybe it was kind of a comfort film for you even. Like, I know I remember at that age also having so many movies on VHS that I think we all had mm-hmm. as that collection of, like, everybody had a copy yeah. of The Mask, mm-hmm. Free Willy, and probably yeah. Twister.
Yeah. I think that there is something to that. I mean, and I think many, and we've talked about many times, right, that there are those movies where you have an emotional attachment to because of when you saw it. And mm-hmm. so it can sometimes, because of that, become difficult in some ways, even, you know, judging the movie later on. And I don't know if that's the case per se, but yeah, this is a movie that just kind of stuck with me. And I think a big part of that had to do with the experience I had seeing it in the theater. And, it just does bring back, in a lot of ways, good memories from that time period of going to movies with friends and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, I do love that. So, So this being a movie that both of us have seen many times,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about this, because as I was rewatching it for the podcast, and I think this might be my third time seeing it this year, because I think I watched it before Twisters came out, and
right.
then my wife and I actually just caught it on television. At some point, and then of course I rewatched it here for the podcast, as I always try to do. And one of the things that did really stick out to me, in this one, in this rewatch, was the idea that each character, especially our two main characters with Joe and Bill, they have, it seems like, very set motivations for everything that kind of is driving them, and then that kind of launches us into the story. And to me, that's almost really what sets this movie apart and makes it more interesting, because it's not just a movie about visual effects, but really it is a movie driven by these characters, their experiences apart, together, what's happening, you know, in the context of the film itself. And all of that is really moving them forward and making everything feel like something you can be invested in from a character standpoint, as much as you're invested in the just kind of the, you know, destructive nature of the film, watching tornadoes, you know, rip things apart.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because it's something that I think, without explicitly saying, you kind of get from watching, but don't necessarily actively think about. So I appreciate you saying that, because it is true. I think that if Joe and Bill don't work as individual full characters with their own motivations and arcs, that the whole rest of the movie falls apart, because then it's just you're watching weather. You know, So I think you have to have that, and then also how they work together, because otherwise it could be really boring. And I think that they're both such strong motivations in general to be able to make it interesting. I loved that they really leaned into making Bill all about good instincts. That, like, he could pick up some dirt and watch which way it blows in the wind and be able to guess accurately where the twister would be going next. That's cool. I don't know if that's true, but it's cool if it is.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more in that. I think one of the things that does make this interesting, you mentioned, you know, that aspect to that, to the character, which I think is excellent. And something, like you said, they kind of really lean into this person being very in tune with weather, being in tune with, nature in a way that makes him special compared to, you know, other people who storm chase, right? Which, you know, makes him an interesting character than to watch. But, you know, I think one of the things that really just stuck out to me again in the rewatch too is that, you know, we start the movie by creating motivation for the character of Jo as to why she's so obsessed with tornadoes and wanting to stop the tornadoes, and even kind of doing a good job, I think, of showing the irrationality in some of that she has because of this experience that she's had, you know, her dad dying because of a tornado, and, you know, so her absolute obsession with this is in some ways, you know, as shown as, you know, being unhealthy and everything, but you can understand why that's the case if you've gone through a traumatic experience like she did at a very young age. And then, you know, on the other side of that, you've got, you know, the motivation that Bill's out there because he wants to get the divorce paper signed. He's trying to get remarried. But then what sucks him in, again, sorry with all the puns of that, but
yeah,
is the fact that he helped create Dorothy. They've actually, you know, created it now. They're going to try and put it in the field. His relationship with Jo, and then his anger at Jonas for kind of stealing their ideas, and all of these things compound to make it feel realistic that he would get roped back in, right? And again, I think that's one of those things, like even reading the fact that I was doing some behind the scenes looking for what, you know, this movie's filming was like and everything, and they had rewrites on the script and all this kind of stuff. But it seems like they really got to a place with these main two characters that allowed us to be able to be fully invested in not just a visual effects extravaganza, but it really allowed us to kind of be able to be invested in these characters, and it makes their story interesting. And I would argue, and I want to ask you, do you think that's what makes this movie rewatchable?
I think that's not the only reason, but it's a big reason. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's plenty of other reasons that go along with it, but it does seem like to me that one of the main reasons that this movie is rewatchable is because, you know, the characters are more than two-dimensional characters. And I think that's something that, again, it's just, it's really interesting to be able to watch a movie like this, and I think for all intents and purposes, honestly, a movie about, you know, tornadoes and stuff doesn't feel like a movie that should be all that interesting. And yet I think, you know, they do a good job with that. So I think it's a great time. You know, we talk about the motivations or whatever, but, you know, the people who bring these characters to life, especially our two main characters with Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton. But I was really interested to see that with Helen Hunt's character, you know, she was actually not the first person that they wanted to have play this character. And in fact, when he brought her up, the director, they just weren't sure if she was going to be able to pull it off, because she isn't a really big name right now. I mean, she's on mm-hmm. Mad About You, but that's really the only place people have seen her. But I want to ask you, like, is it just because we've seen this movie too many times, or can you really picture anybody else playing this role?
I mean, there's maybe a handful of people I think could sub in for her. Honestly, the first person I think of is Jodie Foster, who kind of looks like her. But it would be a totally different vibe. I think that's the thing I love so much about Helen Hunt in this role. I feel like she didn't know what she was getting into and decided to take a chance on doing this role. And yeah. I'm so glad that she did, because she can play a romantic interest, but it's not overt. She's able to really make things in this movie feel like comfortable and unintentional, and that there's just chemistry there. And so it feels like two people that have just always been meant to be together, rather than, ugh, this is a sappy romance within a tornado movie. And I think she really also plays well the look of somebody who is effortlessly beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
I seriously wondered if they had to do much makeup and hair for her, because she just comes across on screen like she threw, you know, I woke up like this, you know, threw this on and she looks great. And I'm just like, that's not fair.
I mean, when she got out of the shower there, I was like, oh, yeah, she just got out of the shower and her hair looks that good. But no, right. I know exactly what you mean. No, I mean, I think there are other people that could have played this role. You might have been able to put in this role somebody like Sandra Bullock, maybe. Somebody like that. But there is something that... And it was the thing that she had on Mad About You. I watched that show, and there's a wit and sarcasm to her that's biting, but it doesn't come off in a way that doesn't make her likable, which is not easy to do for anyone, male or female, honestly. And I think she pulls it off really well. But I also feel like, you know, she just feels believable as this scientist in this character, you know, obviously in a way that Denise Richards playing, you know, Christmas Jones in the James Bond film doesn't at all, right? Mm-hmm. And yet she just is great in this movie. And I think she elevates the material. She makes the character believable. She makes her incredibly watchable. You like being with her on screen. And then, like you mentioned, her chemistry with Bill Paxton, I think, is fantastic. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting things to me is they actually wanted Tom Hanks for this role.
I know. I read that too and went, really?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like his thing.
No, it doesn't. And he passed on it, but he recommended this to Bill Paxton, I think they made the right choice, because he just kind of has I think he has an everyman quality that Tom Hanks does. But I also feel like, at least at this point in Hanks's career, there's also maybe an edge to Bill Paxton a little bit. Right, that maybe isn't there for a Tom Hanks type of personality, and you need that for this role, for it to be pulled off. And so I think he's great in the role, and again, putting him together with, you know, Helen Hunt, they do just such a great job.
Oh yeah, well, and I agree with you, especially about his edge. Because I'm thinking about, you know, things like his performance in Aliens, which had come long before this. And he always was able to really lean into that kind of feel with a character. And yet here, then also be able to pull it back and have that softness like he has in a lot of his scenes with Melissa. And then, you know, even moments with Joe where, you know, he's the one that actually has to remind her that she is chasing a ghost. And he's the only one who can because he's not a family member, but she trusts him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think you needed him here. And I think, although I love Tom Hanks, I think that he definitely made the right decision recommending Paxton for this role.
Yeah.
I couldn't see anyone else doing it. And like we both said, their chemistry together with him and Helen Hunt just works.
Right. Well, and I isn't that really, I mean, you need these two characters to kind of pop off the screen together for this movie to work, right? As we talked about, the idea of the motivations that we're playing with the characters are things that help. But you need Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton to be able to sell both of those and be able to sell the romantic love interest type of stuff as well that goes along with this story for all of that to work. And you, of course, have to be bought into the you know, the magnetic pull between these two, right? And so, which I guess, you know, it happens a lot in films, but, you know, we do have that love triangle with Melissa, who is the one that Bill Paxton is hoping to be able to get the divorce papers signed by Joe so that he can marry. How do you feel about her as a character in that storyline, you know, especially even just the way it wraps up?
So it was interesting actually reading more about the characters behind the scenes, because she was added later on sort of as a way for the audience to feel a part of the action. And I get that because I definitely have that feeling now when I go back and see it again. But there are moments where they lean too much into the joke with her.
Yeah.
And it just feels cheesy.
Yes.
Like I'm thinking of the scene where she's going, I got to talk to you later. We got cows.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but you know, there are a couple of moments where she's really great. And I think that, Jamie Gertz did so well in that scene in the diner, where she says something like, I don't blame you, you know, if you're still in love with him. And you can feel the tension in that room.
Yes, yeah.
You know, no, that was great.
It's great.
So I just think there were times when they could have reeled it in a little bit with the dialogue for her.
No, I think you're 100% right on that. And, you know, I do think it is interesting to be able to have her as the avatar for the audience, right? You know, and to allow us to be able to have somebody that we can relate to, because, you know, most people, the majority of people that are seeing this film are not storm chasers. And so having her there and allowing, you know, the other characters, especially like Dusty, to explain things to her so that the audience understands what we're talking about, I think is great. I think you're absolutely right in kind of nailing the fact that there are points where we lean too much into the joke with the people she's talking to on the phone. There are places where, you know, it's just, it's too much and it doesn't need to be there. I think they're trying to be too funny and it doesn't necessarily always land. And I do find it interesting too. I mean, and this is something to where, you know, they're not going to do this, but the way in which, you know, she tells Bill, the line that she tells Bill, right, at the end, when they are going their separate ways, where she's like, and I'm not really even that sad about it. Like, there's something really interesting there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for somebody who's supposed to be a therapist, you know, to realize that she's been in a relationship that maybe she knew was never going to go anywhere, was never going to last, is kind of fascinating to me. And of course, we don't get to explore that at all. And yet, there's something to me that instead of that seeming like a trite thing, it seems very real. Right. Because that's something that happens to many people, right? That they've ended up in a relationship that by the time it ends, they're not sad about it because it's not a relationship that was really ever going to go into there. And they kind of knew that all along. And yet that part was really interesting to me in that. And so it kind of makes me wish that, again, they had leaned a little less into the joke with her and, like, maybe leaned a little bit more into the nuances of her character as a person so that that moment would have meant even more. But, I think for all intents and purposes, the character works the way – and I guess that whole – relationship, I guess, works the way it's meant to for the film and, you know, for our two main characters then to get together in the end. So,
yeah, well, and what I got from it was therapists are people too.
sure.
She can tell everyone else what to do and yet doesn't know how to figure out her own life. And also is a great juxtaposition to Joe because it's actually showing you that Bill is trying to do what he thinks is the sensible move in life. Mm-hmm. He's gone from being a storm chaser to a weatherman and he's getting some crap about it from the team. He's marrying someone who's more, you know, kind of what they're showing as the run-of-the-mill city folk lady. Being a therapist, mm-hmm. and she's very well dressed in this beige suit out in the middle of nowhere in the mud. And then you've got Joe, who is the girl next door, who loves adventure and views going riding around chasing tornadoes with Bill as fun, whereas Melissa is absolutely in fear for her life, as she probably should be. So I like all those contrasts.
Yeah. No, me too. I think it's well said. And speaking of you know, the other characters here, the motley crew that we ride around with, man, I think that's one of the things that also makes this film work is that crew, each character has a gravitas to it that you immediately kind of know, even if you don't spend a ton of time with that character, who they are and what they're about, which I love. And obviously, you know, we get to spend more time with Philip Seymour Hoffman as Dusty and Alan Ruck as Rabbit, and then, you know, less so with the rest of the characters. But still, every single one of them just feels like a real person, you know, with the way in which they're just portraying that person whenever they're on screen and the things that they're doing. And it just all seems to be very coherent. And that is good casting. You know, that is something really special. And I think also that is one of the things that makes this movie kind of stand apart as well, is because of those, you know, motley crew of characters all feeling like people that you could actually meet.
Yeah, I love the feel that they give this group of, you know, kind of a ragtag group, that they are the broke scientists that are out there doing this because they love it. And they're also best friends. And then rightfully so, like you said, they each have their own unique traits about them as well. Like Dusty really leans into the classic rock. Like he's listening to Eric Clapton. He's got the CRT TV in his van. And he's wearing stuff that looks like he got it, you know, from his childhood bedroom years ago. Like, he doesn't even put his arms through his jacket. He just has it hanging off his head by the hood.
Yes.
And then Rabbit, you know, is the guy that's all about the maps. He figures out the route. So they've each got their own specialty as far as what they do on the team, sort of like we expect from like a Mission Impossible. But they also have even more going for them than just that. They've got their own musical taste, as we see with Dusty versus Preacher, and then Bill and Joe. So I love that they also include that piece of it to make them stand out a little more.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's really one of the most fun parts of the film, you know, is you watch, like you said, the behind the scenes, they kind of pair off into these twos, you know, and they have their back and forth bickering that they're doing. And it just, it's fun, you know, and it makes the movie fun. And I think it's just one of the things, you know, that makes this work. And I wanted to ask you about the villains of the film, because there are really two. And the first one is a person in Jonas Miller, played by Cary Elwes. And then, of course, the other one is just nature itself. And man, I feel like this is the point where Cary Elwes was making a living playing the low rent villain in films, right? Like the guy that you just hated because he's such a turd. And he just does such a great job with that.
Well, he even got a Southern accent in this one. And, you know, that's not his usual accent, but I felt like he did it believably here. And he is, I mean, he's one of those people that you don't want to typecast him, and he is more versatile than that, but he's very good at playing a jerk.
Yes, he is.
And also, again, with the contrast, you know, they're also showing him here as the well-funded, well-dressed, professional scientist, but he's like the book smart guy who doesn't actually have the instincts, like Bill says, or, you know, the experience. He just thinks that he's better because he has all of the fancy equipment and goes out and makes a massive mistake and dies. And so, you know, there is something to be said here for showing how much experience is valuable, as much or more than fancy equipment and, you know, being book smart.
Yeah. I think that one of the most interesting parts of him as a character is the way in which he represents the person who's out in this for all the wrong reasons, which is to make himself famous and make himself money. You know, whereas the other characters that we have here are very committed to doing this, either specifically for the science or to save lives, or for both, right?
Yeah.
And he's just the guy who doesn't care. And I think that really represents that idea of, you know, the corporate character and the corporate person who just doesn't have any of those cares. And what it does is it makes him bad at his job, right? And because he's so full of himself and he's so about himself that he's not willing to listen to anybody else. And it's clearly on display here. And yes, he is very much a character in that sense. But I think the importance sometimes of characters and seeing them is to be confronted by the fact that many of us can be doing the same things, right? And so I like that. And then I do like that on the other side, a villain that you kind of have in the films is nature and the tornadoes themselves. And of course, they're even represented by the sounds that are used to create the sounds of the tornadoes. I mean, they use lots of animal sounds to kind of create the sounds of the moving tornadoes and the wind and all this stuff. And, you know, this idea of this villain that we don't really have control over, and yet we want to be able to understand So we can find better ways to live with. And that's just a fascinating thing, too, in this film. And I think it's something that they actually do well in the movie, because we all live in places in the world where we have to deal with, you know, natural disasters. You know, I lived in Tornado Alley growing up, you know, and, you know, people on the East Coast, specifically kind of Christy, where you live, hurricanes can be a thing. And then, you know, you've got where I live now, and we never know if a volcano might blow. And so it's just like we're all in places where to understand the world we live in, nature is incredibly important for our survival, you know, and it's something that can, you know, in some ways be even seen as something we're fighting against or a villain in that sense. And so, yeah, I kind of like that the movie utilizes that, and I think they do a good job of it.
Oh yeah, well, and especially with Joe and the dialogue that, you know, people also joke about because it kind of sounds a little cheesy, but that she is blaming this, saying that the tornado came after them specifically, as if it was sentient and premeditated. And, you know, obviously, since she was a child when it happened, you could totally see how you would grow up thinking that, because the neighbor's house is still standing in just fine and you don't have your father anymore.
Exactly.
But it's that she never picked up that it was just a terrible accident and that there is no rhyme or reason to why this happens with tornadoes specifically. But, you know, at least with her wanting to study them, that was her way of figuring things out and trying to prevent it from happening to other families.
I think that is a great point. I wanted to ask you, too, the movie, you know, like most Hollywood movies, right? You film in a place and then you call it that, but it's not really filmed there. And one of the things that the director did was specifically say, hey, we're filming this in Oklahoma. We're not filming this in California. And so most of the movie is filmed all over Oklahoma, and the only time they change it is the very end of the film, where they had to film in Iowa because, as anybody knows, as seasons change, especially as you get into summer and stuff, the landscape in the South changes pretty drastically. And so they ended up having to film those last sequences in Iowa, standing in for Oklahoma. But I wanted to ask you just if you felt like that just changed the dynamic of the movie and the way that as you watch the movie, that it gives an authenticity to the film, and if they made a good decision doing that.
Absolutely. I think it was the right decision because a lot of this stuff, yes, you could do with effects like with the tornadoes, but I think that all the scenes where they're driving through that ditch with the mud to the tiny bridge that they hide under, or driving through the cornfield, or the shot from above as they're leaving Wakita, supposedly, are all really good establishing shots that you're not going to get without filming somewhere realistic to farm country like that. So I think it was definitely the right decision and made it feel more believable than if you had tried to film it on a soundstage in California or tried to film it in more rural parts of California, because the landscape is just totally different.
Yeah. No, I mean, this, I just could not agree with you more. And again, growing up in Dallas, Texas, which is not all that far from Oklahoma, and the types of places that they filmed in Oklahoma, 100%, this looks and feels like the places that I know and what this should look like, you know? And it does completely add to the film. And what I also think that it does is it it brings to life the plight of people who live in Tornado Alley, you know, by actually filming in the place that this happens. And kind of in some ways even celebrating it, right? You know, we're celebrating that part of the country in this. And so I was very glad that that was the case. And again, I never questioned watching the film, even when it first came out, right? Like, I legit never questioned the movie because it just felt right. Because they had done what they needed to do and filmed in the right place to make this work. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I love that they did that. And I think they did a great job in that. So I wanted to ask you, obviously, this movie is from 1996. And when it came out, of course, the VFX, the visual effects and the sound design here were a huge part of the draw for this film and the big theater experience then because of that. So how do you feel like now as you watch the movie, they stand up, you know, all these years later?
Most of the movie is still really groundbreaking, especially if you consider it in the time frame it came out with the visual effects and the sound design. I think for sure both were essential to making this good because if you've seen something like Sharknado, you know it can be bad. It was intentionally bad, but still bad, both sound and visual effects. So if you're going to do a movie about tornadoes, you want them to look realistic and to actually make people afraid for the stakes of the characters. The only times that I think it wasn't good that still stick out to me, the first one I kind of forgot till I rewatched it. Did you notice the intro when they first spell out the word Twister? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
It was those like ugly 90s block letters of a dramatic movie, and you're like, no, let's not. Yeah. And the cow.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But I mean,
especially since they made, I mean, yeah, it was a digital cow. Right. So
it's like, there's no way you're going to make a cow spinning in a tornado look realistic unless you're actually doing it. And you're not going to do that to that poor cow. So it is what it is, but it was noticeable. But yeah, I mean, I think otherwise, if you think of all the ways it could have gone wrong, even just choosing the sounds for tornadoes in a movie like this, they did a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of a time when I remember hearing a tornado in real life, so I totally buy it. And that's the main thing that you need here. And ILM is who did this, so obviously it's going to be good.
Yeah, no, I really agree. I think that a lot of this still really works. I think that what's really interesting is watching it on 4K, and they've kind of they did some slight changes to some of the things where you know they actually changed some of the colors on purpose to get that green look. Anybody who's lived in Tornado Alley understands what that green is in the sky. And I think that it was really, really interesting to watch them to kind of push that a little bit with the 4K edition on purpose to really try to bring that out that they couldn't necessarily do in the beginning, you know, with the technology available back in the day. And so, yes, in that sense, you know, I think they do a great job in that. And, you know, I think the beauty of this is that even though, you know, some of the effects do look dated and they should, you know, it's from 96, that the movie still really works, I think, because of the way in which the sound, especially if you have a really good sound system at home, makes you still feel enveloped by the weather that's happening, which I think is great. And I thought that they did a great job in that, and it still really works, you know. And so if you've got, you know, a good 4K TV and a nice Dolby Atmos sound system, you're really going to enjoy this film again at home with the 4K release, because it does a great job of making you feel like you're right in the middle of it. And so, and with that sound comes a soundtrack that, you know, was pretty popular back in the day with the likes of Tori Amos and Van Halen and Lisa Loeb being on it. And so what did you think about those needle drops that we get in the film?
I love them. I think their choice of songs really fits this style. I'm thinking especially too of Shania Twain playing in the diner. It's just very nostalgic. And that's something I think too that plays in really well here with another piece I wanted to mention, of just that's the feel that they give to this whole group as well, of Joe and her team, is that they have this small town rebellious and warm feel to them. And so you see things like they're having steak and eggs at her Aunt Meg's house, stopping at the diner, the CRT TV, and he's playing Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
And even the style of vehicles they drive, you know, they're all driving stuff that's old, beat up trucks. The trailer on the back of a pickup truck to look like a camper. They're just trying to make it, you know? And so you feel this kinship with them, and the music feeds into that. And so that's like specifically what I'm thinking of, the song Humans Being by Van Halen playing over them driving through and getting excited about chasing the next one down. You feel like you're along for the ride with them. And I think
yes,
the music there is so important to that.
Yeah. This is a very sentimental movie in the sense that at this point in time, I was really beginning to explore music, and this movie helped get me into Van Halen.
Awesome.
In the first place. This is a song I still love when it's playing and it's blaring and they're, you know, just bounding down the road in those beat up vehicles. It's just fantastic. And like you said, too, the other music that we hear throughout the film is so perfectly placed in the sense of the type of music that these type of people would be listening to. You know, like, I mean, all the things that you have Dusty playing feel so him, right? Because mm-hmm. he wouldn't be a country fan. He would be the type of dude who's into all this other kind of slightly alternative music at the time. And he's the main person we kind of get music through for the most part. So it just so works. And I think that is really fun about the film. And it's one of those things where a movie back then, when they did it right, this is what you felt with the soundtrack, you know. And I love the stuff that they use here. And yes, there is some nostalgia for me in that. But I also just think it works for the period we're in. And it's still music that's good. So, all in all, what do you guess? I mean, we pretty much had nothing but effusive praise for Twister so far. So I'm really on the edge of my seat, honestly, to see what you're going to rate Twister.
So, one other thing I just want to add in before I give my final rating. I also love the pacing of the movie.
Yeah, great point. Great point.
They specifically talk about that if you look up more behind the scenes stuff about the movie, that even the dialogue was considered, the words they would use and how fast they would speak to keep the pacing up tempo. They didn't want it to be exciting while they're chasing and then suddenly die down. So that's why it feels like a continuous ramp up to the very end with the F5, and never a break in the middle. And I love that. And I think it keeps you gripping the edge of your seat.
Absolutely.
So I will say, just because of the couple little things I mentioned with the effects, I take off half a star. But it's 4.5 out of 5 jackets hanging on by the hood.
That's great. You know, I still really like this movie. And it's just fun. right? Like, I really enjoy rewatching it. And part of that, you know, is that I've seen this movie now a few times. And I'm really glad that I have, you know, gotten the opportunity to see it a few times this year. At every time I watch it, I'm still invested in it, which is kind of crazy, right?
Right.
And so it was really interesting because where I had this movie before was at 3.5.
Wow.
And yeah, and it was, what was interesting to me in this was rewatching it, and our conversation about the motivations at the beginning is actually what brought this up to a 4 for me. Because I think that the characterization in this, and the thing that keeps me coming back to it, is I like being with these characters, specifically, you know, Joe and Bill and everything that happens between those two characters and then everybody else involved, right? And so in that, yeah, this is a 4-star film for me, you know, and I don't think there's anything guilty about this. It should not be a guilty pleasure. It's just a fun movie. It's a great movie. It's a great ride. It's the type of film you can just put in and have a good time watching. And why should we apologize, you know, in any way, shape or form with liking that type of film? You know, and so not every movie needs to be, you know, Schindler's List. And so I think I love having these type of films that I can just pop in and watch pretty much anytime and just have a good time. So, Christy, if people though wanted to catch up with you, talk you into watching Twisters, in the theater before it leaves, where would people find you?
Well, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Bespin Bell. And then I'm also, of course, on Facebook. And if you want to find my finished show I did with my friends Amanda and Teresa, it's called Sabers and Spells on the Skywalking Through Neverland Network called Skynet. But what about you?
Well, you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me with a bunch of other shows in the Star Trek realm. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, I've got 2 shows. One's called Owlpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and Aggressive Negotiations, where John Mills and I talk Star Wars each and every week. But as always, thank you so much for joining us.
And y'all come back now, you hear? Thank you.